She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And today we are going to be giving you the opportunity to think about forest fires, their severity, their cost, and how it all fits in with the acceleration of climate change on our planet. Some really serious thoughts to share and hopefully inspire you to get engaged in the whole conversation around climate change. We can't be afraid of it. We've got to engage. Joining me today in studio is Don Falk. He is an associate professor at the University of Arizona School of Natural Resources and the Environment. Don, I welcome you, and I will expand on the welcome and of your many accomplishments, because as I said to you off air, it's really important for me that our listening audience understand the person that I have sitting in the studio with me and how you are really internationally recognized as an expert on fire. And it certainly has the severe impacts that we all feel in the Southwest and in California. So we'll come back to that. I want to thank the University of Arizona for their support of the Mrs. Green's mission and vision and their commitment to sustainability at all levels. There's great things going on at the University of Arizona.
My honor to be here. Thank you.
I'm glad you're here. I would also like to thank Ecobella, one of our national sponsors, for their support in the mission and vision of Mrs. Green's World and for being a partner with us in creating a global community of people who truly do care about the planet. The show is made possible in part because of their support. Ecobella is an international company whose mission is to provide hard-to-find skincare and beauty products that are not going to hurt us. They're good for people, they're good for animals, and they're good for the planet. And as I have said many times before on the show, a heartfelt endorsement, my show, you don't hear a lot of endorsements for products. This is a company that I trust in an industry that I pretty much do not trust. So check them out at ecobella2c's.com, and hopefully you will consider supporting them for the greater good. So let me talk a little bit about Don Falk. And there's 9 pages I could go through, and I'm barely kidding, but to me, it's really important. He has an education from the University of Arizona in biology, a PhD, thank you very much, and I didn't call him doctor, but, you know, I'm Mrs. Green, so it's okay. Tufts University, environmental policy, Oberlin College, international studies. This, my friends, is not a slacker. His research interests include fire ecology. I mean, he knows about the history of fire from probably millions of years ago. Fire history, do you say it? Dendroecology?
That's right.
I love it, and I didn't have to look it up.
The study of ecology through tree rings.
Ecology, okay, tree rings. Fire climatology, ecological scale, restoration ecology, resilience. He has had a number of really incredible positions, received numerous honors and awards, and we'll talk a little bit about that throughout the show. So it's always great to start with a background, highlighting some of your experience and why you're here to talk about fires and the mega fires and its impact in relationship to climate change. So what got you excited about fire?
Well, it's hard to be an ecologist in the Western United States or Western North America and not be aware of the dominant presence of fire in our time. Fires are affecting millions of acres every year, and in some cases destructively and in other cases benignly. And as I began to look at fire as a process in Western forests especially, I began to see that we really don't have a deep enough understanding of how it operates ecologically and what its relationship is to climate change. So that's what brought me into studying fire as an ecologist.
And I know you'll go into this, but I talked to you the other day about up close and personal. When you lose a cabin that you dearly love that was built in the 1950s and cannot be rebuilt on a pristine piece of land in the White Mountains in Greer, Arizona, and you see and feel and experience the devastation of a mega fire, my interest is keen. I was already Mrs. Green and very interested in climate change and why does the bark beetle matter to me and why does the drought matter to me. So I really have a heartfelt interest. And some of the things that you wrote about in the article that brought you to my attention were things that I experienced, like what does scorched earth mean? And people saying, oh, it'll come back. It'll come back. Well, no, not really if you're 62 and want it to come back in this lifetime. So you got interested because you of where you live.
So your experience at losing your cabin is the kind of tragic experience that many, many people have had. And we could look at that, what happened there, and use that as a lens to understand what's happening to fire and forests and land use in today's world. And I think using that as a lens, there's a lot we can understand about why fire is so important and what it tells us about larger patterns in the world.
So when I was young, and I was, forest fires, if they were 10,000 acres, oh my gosh. Now, half a million acres, you know, a little bit bigger, oh my gosh, but that's what's happening. Why the mega fires? That's the looking through the lens.
Right.
What's happening?
So this is exactly right. Since 1984, the average area burned in the western United States has gone up by 250%. And as you say, 20, 30 years ago, a 10,000-acre fire would really be quite
severe.
Notable. Really quite notable. That would be very, very significant. And incidentally, also a fire that, you know, cost more than a few hundred thousand dollars to control would also make the newspapers. Well, now you can increase both of those measures by two orders of magnitude. So 100,000-acre fires, 500,000-acre fires are no longer unusual. They happen every year in different parts, especially in the West, and fires that are costing $10, $20, $30 million a piece are also no longer unusual. And so the scale of fire has gone up and the economic impacts have gone up tremendously. We now spend at the federal level close to $3 billion per year in firefighting and associated fire reclamation, post-fire rehabilitation. If you add in the private costs for property damage and lost economic activity, it's probably closer to $5 billion a year. And so this is having a really big impact, not only on ecosystems, but on our economy.
And when you like what happened, let's fast forward a little bit, when 19 people were killed, literally burned to death in the Yarnell Hill fire, what happened for me in terms of my grieving process was not one life was lost in the Wallow fire. And for that, I am grateful. I can rebuild a cabin, but you cannot replace the devastating loss of lives that the severity of that fire caused. And to me, you know, even that didn't get enough national attention. It's like, oh, that was terrible. It made national news for 2 or 3 days. But going upstream to look at what's happening is what excited me about having you on the show. So what's happening? Why are the mega fires happening?
Right, right. So this is the central question is we can document that fires are getting bigger and they're getting more severe. And the first question is why? So in fire science, we have what's called the fire behavior triangle, which consists of fuels, weather, and topography. And these are the big drivers that govern how a fire behaves. And when we say how a fire behaves, we mean how tall are the flames? How fast is it moving? How much heat is it putting out? So these are the very relevant measures you would use for any fire incident. Well, of those three, let's say for the moment that topography is the one thing that probably has not changed that much in the last 100 years, maybe on small scales.
Right.
But the topography of most areas is essentially a constant. That leaves us with fuels and weather. So let's talk about fuels first. The really important thing about fire to understand is that it's something that ecosystems do. It's not like a hurricane or a tornado or an earthquake, something that falls from above. Fire is a natural ecological process. It's happened for millions of years. In fact, we have charcoal records that show fire occurring 400 million years ago, not long after land plants first became established. And so this idea of fire as being kind of an anomalous or aberrant event is something. It's the first thing we need to shake out of our heads.
That's simply not true.
The
historically,
fact is,
it's almost like a natural process.
It's
of
not almost.
Cleansing.
It is an absolutely natural process, and it's one of the ways that ecosystems get reset. Carbon and nutrients are recycled. There are multiple processes that fire mediates, and so we have essentially natural sustainable fire in Western North America until about the 1880s. In some areas, the fire regime changes earlier, in the early 1800s, and in some cases into the 1900s, and in fact, in parts of Mexico, we still have something approaching the natural fire regime. What happens when you put out the fires that otherwise would have been occurring? Well, the fuel that would have burned in one fire is still there the next year. And then you put out the next year's fire, and that fuel is accumulating. And if you do this over decades, and in fact over a century, you have 100 years worth of accumulation of fuel. And that is simply like piling up a gigantic bonfire where you originally might have had a little campfire that you might warm your hands over. Now you've got 100 years worth of campfire. It's a bonfire. And so when it finally does catch fire, and it does, there is no if about fire. It's only when. And what kind of fire you get. When the fire does finally occur with these gigantic fuel accumulations, it burns with an intensity that we can't control. And that's part of what happened to your cabin in Greer.
People that were there that described leaving Greer, some of the last residents that lived there, and I was one of the people that thought our cabin is so special, you know, you just tell yourself things. But they said it literally, and I learned this from my husband, that the fire itself creates its own weather conditions. So, you know, cinders were being blown from embers from the fire miles ahead, wind creating its own force. You know, one of my friends, Bob Pollock, who lives up there, said he could not drive out there fast enough once it came over the mountain. He said it was so incredibly terrifying. I don't think most people understand the force and the intensity at which it burns. I mean, when I say every single thing in our cabin was destroyed, every piece of metal, every piece of silverware, you know, metal tub, metal cabinets, it was all a crumbled mass of burned, charred remains.
A high severity forest fire can send cloud and debris and hot gases 50, 70,000 feet in a matter of minutes. It's the physics of a canopy fire are quite extraordinary. And as you say, you're quite correct that a fire like that is no longer responding to the upper level winds or the local winds near the surface of the earth. Those play a factor when a fire is burning with less intensity.
Right,
but
right.
When the chain reaction of a big fire, and that's a really good way to think of any fire is a chain reaction, but especially a big crown fire, think of it as a reaction that's just building momentum, and it's pulling in more fuel and preheating more fuels, and so the rate of combustion just goes up and the temperature goes up. It starts to be so powerful, so much energy, that it creates a rolling vortex of flame that's completely independent of what the weather is around it. And incidentally, when those tall plumes called pyrocumulus, just like a cloud except created by fire, when those eventually cool off, they collapse. And you can then have straight down winds at over 100 miles an hour striking the surface and then blowing out in all directions. And that creates the very chaotic behavior, which is extremely dangerous to firefighters and causes fire to spread in very unpredictable directions.
So you mentioned a canopy fire, and I think you should explain that because maybe not everybody is familiar with that term. I, of course, know what it means now, but a canopy fire is so vastly different from one of the natural fires that gets out all of the ground cover and gets rid of debris in the natural process. You're the scientist. You explain it.
Yes, I will. And in fact, my students in my wildland fire class just had an exam on these kinds of fires, so I hope some of them are listening.
I hope they are too.
So we tend to classify fires by which fuels are burning. And so there are ground fuels, which are essentially the litter and duff that are just right at the soil surface. There are what we call surface fuels, which are the small grasses and shrubs that are close to the ground, maybe just a couple of feet tall. And then there are the canopies of the trees, the larger trees, which are 20 to 100 feet off the ground. Each of these fuel layers has its own distinctive ways of burning, and they burn with different intensity and different patterns. And they're all natural. It's important to say that all those three levels of fuel burn under some conditions in some ecosystems, for example, high elevation ecosystems, in lodgepole pine, in Southern California chaparral, number of cases where canopy fires are actually fairly typical. And a great example of that in the West would be these high elevation spruce fir forests, which only have fire every 300 to 500 years. But when the fire happens, when it's dry enough, and the conditions are suitable, then you'll get a crown fire and it'll essentially reset the system to begin growing all over again. So a canopy fire or a crown fire is one that's burning either through the canopy of a forest or where the canopy is being burned from below by the surface fuels and the flames are reaching up into the canopy. And incidentally, there's a fourth level of fuel called ladder fuels, which are the fuels that allow, it's a great metaphor, allow the flames to climb from the surface, from the small shrubs up into the canopy. Well, what are ladder fuels? They are small trees, they're branches, all the fuels that connect the surface to the canopy. And when you have this 100 years worth of fuel accumulation and fire suppression, one of the things that really increases is the amount of ladder fuel. So it goes from having a big gap where fire can't jump from the low shrubs up into the canopy to being able to just climb right up that ladder. And that's one of the reasons that we now understand we're seeing more canopy fires, because the canopy is connected to the surface fuels.
And you look at some place like Mount Lemmon, which is to me still devastating. I mean, it looks like a graveyard up there, which is you go up and it's been over 10 years. And that fire wasn't anywhere nearly as big as the Walla fire. It was actually minuscule. Higher concentration of cabins. I think more cabins burned. Only 22 cabins burned in Greer. But the size of the fire, it was severe. It was intense. But I don't think it compared in acreage. You know, it had the perfect storm, high elevation and all of that. But in terms of relatively to the Walla fire versus the Mount Lemmon fire, was the Walla fire more severe in intensity, not just in the number of acres it burned?
Right.
There was my question.
Yes. Okay. So we all need to know if the fires, in addition to getting bigger, are causing more ecological damage. That's underlying question. And let's come back in a moment to your question of what happens to these ecosystems after fire. Let's simply ask about this property of the fire itself. So typically, in most large wildland fires, the area that burns with high severity is on the order of 20 to 30%. It's not the entire perimeter. When you hear on the evening news, oh, 10,000 acres were charred or 15,000 acres were blackened, it's really not true. What's left behind is a mosaic of severely burned areas, moderately burned areas, which are mostly burning surface fuels, as we were saying a minute ago, and then some areas that actually are unburned. So if you draw a line around any large fire, including the Walla fire, including the Aspen fire, including Sierra Grande in New Mexico, within the perimeter of any of these fires, two-thirds of the area is either low to moderate severity burned or not burned at all. And so if you think of a mosaic, of a tile mosaic, all these fires have that property. And that turns out to be something that has not changed as much from several decades ago, that proportion of the area that is burning with high severity has gone up, but it hasn't gone up that much. But one very important thing has changed, and that is that the high severity used to be kind of sprinkled around the landscape in 10 and 20 and 100 acre patches, and now we have huge contiguous patches of high severity, and the ecological recovery of those is much slower.
And, you know, we are up on a break in about a minute, but one of the things I'd really like to talk about when we come back is why the difference when people say scorched earth, when they told us that, we had people come up and we talked about rebuilding and putting trees up. I mean, the Forest Service was in there doing restoration work, I think, when the smoke was still, you know, in the air, and they planted hundreds of trees that have all died on the whole hill around us. So I'd like to talk about the scorched earth and the complexity of that issue as it relates to healing of the planet? I mean, I think that's a really important question. Okay, so everybody, we're going to take a short break. I know you want to stay here with us. Joining me in studio is Don Falk, an associate professor at the University of Arizona School of Natural Resources and the Environment. It's also, he's also connected and part of the big vision of the Institute of the Environment that Diana Liverman and Jonathan Overpeck are spearheading and making happen. So we'll be back in a little bit and we'll talk more about the scorched earth. I want to talk about its relationship to climate change because it is not an isolated thing that it's, oh, it's dry here and it's flooding over there. So we'll be right back, everybody. Stay here with me. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. We'll be right back.
In the mid-Tucson summer, you would expect it to be over 100 degrees. But deep beneath the University of Arizona's compost heap, temperatures can hit 160. Started by the Compost Cats student group, the U of A Compost Project is collecting tons of waste from around campus and keeping it out of landfills. Gathering garbage and converting it into a useful product for the community? Now that's a hot idea indeed. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. The 2013 VW Jetta TDI is the sedan people love to love. It comes with a zippy turbocharged diesel engine that's 90% cleaner burning than previous diesel engines, and it goes farther on a tank of gas than a Toyota Prius. Chapman Volkswagen has a great selection of Jetta TDIs, so choose yours today at chapmantucson.com or in person at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson.
You can always find things around the house to give to Goodwill, but I have a bigger reason to give. A while back, I lost my job and I couldn't even support my family. A lot of people don't know Goodwill can help you find a job, but that's what they did for me. I've had this job for 7 years and I love going to work. You know how they say Goodwill changes lives? Well, it's true. Goodwill needs your donations now more than ever. Please donate today.
Bookman Sports Exchange is now open at 3330 East Speedway. We're taking our passion and experience of buying, selling, and trading books and music and applying it to the world of sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear. We are giving you another way to save money on the things that you love, Bookman style. Remember, Bookman Sports Exchange, sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear, now open daily from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Speedway east of Country Club. Check out bookmans.com for more info.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And if you've been with us from the beginning, we are certainly been given the gift of a lot to think about. Joining me in studio is Don Falk, an associate professor at the University of Arizona School of Natural Resources and the Environment. I think it's very safe to say he's an internationally recognized expert on fire in general, the history of fire, global perspectives on fire, and just what kind of mega fires we are experiencing, especially in the West, and what we can expect in the future. And Don, you pointed out on the break that this is a national and international audience. I mean, I have lots of people listening in the UK and in a little cadre of people in Buenos Aires and people in Australia. So the talking about it kind of parochial, you know, we're in a parochial sense of it's right here. But Mount Lemmon is outside of Tucson, Arizona, and you go from what our elevation is about 3,000 feet to over 8,000 feet in about 50 minutes. Every ecological system mm-hmm. is represented on the way up. And if you live in Tucson in the summer, you can start rolling your windows down like at mile point 11 or 12, something like that. It's like, can we take the windows down now? So that's a vast ecological diversity that's represented. In Greer, it's very different. That's in the northeastern part of the state, and it's mostly ponderosa pines. It's an elevation. Our cabin was at 8,200 feet, but not nearly as a diverse a journey as the road to Mount Lemmon. So can you speak to the impacts of what happens on a Mount Lemmon and if it's any different than what happens in a Greer after the fire.
Right. So up until this point, we've been talking about fire behavior, how big fires get, how much heat they put out.
Devastating they are.
And the kind of the immediate post-fire impacts. Now, when all the TV crews go home and the smoke dies down, now we have the question of what will happen to the ecosystem. How do ecosystems recover from fire? And let's say right at the outset that it's very hard to generalize. If you have listeners in Australia, they have had extraordinary fire behavior, extraordinarily devastating, in going all the way back into the 1930s. Big fires in South America, big fires in Indonesia in 1997 and 98 that put out almost 12% of the global carbon dioxide emission for that year, those fires. So fire is a worldwide phenomenon. And so it's difficult and perhaps somewhat dangerous to generalize.
Right.
But let's look for the moment at ecosystems, at least in Western North America, from Western Canada into Mexico, and ask, how do ecosystems recover after a fire? So we've already said that fire has been part of ecosystems for millions and indeed tens of millions of years. And so that means that it's a safe bet that many organisms that live in our forests and grasslands and shrublands have some level of adaptation to fire.
Right.
It turns out, of course, to be true that many of the dominant tree species, for example, in Western forests, Douglas fir and ponderosa pine, lodgepole pine and Jeffrey pine and many others, have a high degree of adaptation to surviving fire. And they do this by having thick bark or tree canopies that are lifted well off the ground or many other adaptations. Some species like lodgepole pine actually have cones that only open after the heat of a fire melts a waxy substance that holds the cone together. The cones stay up in the tree. When a crown fire comes through a lodgepole pine forest, the cones, which are tightly closed, are still there. The waxy, the bract opens, the seeds fall to the ground, and you can have a carpet of new lodgepole pine seedlings the year after. Another species that's clearly adapted to post-fire recovery is aspen, which is widespread throughout the West. Aspen actually survives most of the time below ground. We don't even see it. There are these extensive networks called clones that persist underground. And when the above ground forest is cleared away by a fire, that releases the aspen
from... Aspens are the first to come back.
They're the first. They can be back in weeks.
Yep.
And so I give these examples to show that there are deeply ingrained evolutionary adaptations to fire, to responding to fire in many plants and animals. It's interesting to note, by the way, that the mortality of large animals like bear and elk and bison and deer is relatively low, even in big fires. And even in the Yellowstone fires, when people thought that the wolf and the elk populations would be wiped out, hardly any mortality. And the reason is, again, that animals have behavioral adaptations to fire, and they just adapt to it the way they would adapt to a thunderstorm. On the other extreme, you have cases where, after the fire, the ecosystem is absolutely devastated. One example that I'm studying and a number of colleagues are studying is in the Las Conchas fire in 2011, which took place in the Valles Caldera National Preserve and Bandelier National Monument in the Jemez Mountains in northern New Mexico. There are entire watersheds there that are completely denuded of trees, where every tree has been killed for miles. And moreover, the soils have been burnt, all the organic matter has been burnt. And then they had heavy rains after the fires, tremendous amount of soil erosion and flooding. And so those ecosystems have had just about as serious an assault as you could imagine. And so it's a good bet that the recovery, if it ever happens in those systems, is going to be very, very slow. So on one hand, you have ecosystems that bounce right back, and we can put grasslands in that category too. Grasslands and fire have a 10 million year old love affair. Grasses love fire because it it burns off the competition, it knocks back the woody species, and actually puts nutrients into the soil.
Back. Yeah.
And of course, fire loves grass, because what could be easier than a prairie, a nice dry prairie?
Right.
So grasses and fire absolutely love each other, and they probably maintain each other and have for millions of years. So you have these ecosystems where the recovery from fire, in other words, is really quick. And it's an evolutionary adaptation on the part of all the species that are there. And then you have this other extreme where we're having this extreme fire behavior that we think goes way beyond anything that has happened historically. It's the result of our keeping back the dam of fire for 100 to 150 years. And then when the dam breaks, you don't get a trickle, you get a flood.
Right, a deluge, yeah. So go on then for the, let's use the Mount Lemmon and the Greer example, because to me, in Greer, there are really signs of things coming back, not on our property, of course.
Right.
But at Mount Lemmon, when I go up to Summer Haven, it's still depressing to me.
Well, I'm just going to tell you.
Let's just say that.
It's depressing, but I'm going to say here on your show, you don't have to worry quite as much. And let's talk about why. One thing about ecosystem recovery is we have to think about ecosystem time. We want everything to happen the next year. If things are green the year after an event, we'll say, great, that was no big deal. The ecosystem came right back. And so if we see aspen or lodgepole, we're happy. It happened on a time scale that we can understand. If it takes 5 years, we might be feeling a little nervous, and we might be concerned that there could be some species that won't come back, or there could be soil erosion. But the fact is, you know, that some processes, it may take 5 years for the seeds to disperse back into that site. It might take 10 years. Now, what if it starts taking a human lifetime for an ecosystem to recover? That's right. Does that mean that the ecosystem has been stressed beyond its limits? This is a really important question in ecological science right now that we do not have a good sense of. We all feel that if an ecosystem recovers, meaning that there are new plants and shrubs and grasses and animals are repopulating, within a year or two, we consider that a nice recovery because we can understand it. It's at our time scale. But we do see evidence in ecological history using tree rings and pollen and charcoal and many other
scientific collections.
Many other lines of evidence when we look back into deep time in ecosystem recovery that sometimes the recoveries are slower. And this is even before we started messing with the system. Sometimes these recovery times can be 50 to 100 years or longer. And so the first caveat is just to say that simply because things aren't happening as fast as we think they should on our short attention span soundbite kind of expectation that everything will happen just at the snap of a finger.
Yesterday, actually.
It is true that some ecological recovery processes unfold over many decades. And so that means the question then becomes, we go up to Mount Lemmon, this beautiful 9,000-foot mountain outside of Tucson, which incidentally has a sister mountain, the Rincons, which is very similar in many ways, except there are no roads, no ski areas, no town.
We can't go eat out up there on a Saturday afternoon.
And the two have had very, very different ecological and fire histories in the 20th century. So now we go look at a severely burned area, which we can drive up and see, as you pointed out. Well, we have students actually in our laboratory who are studying this very question, and they are looking in great detail at whether there is recovery in these severely burned areas. One thing we find is that even though the trees, the beautiful old overstory trees, which are irretrievably lost, let's not try to paper that over.
Right.
There is really, you know, a priceless ecological value is lost in some of these big fires. But what does happen is that we are seeing grasses and an array of native shrub species coming in very quickly, so that there are areas in Mount Lemmon inside the severe burned area that are now shrub fields. Well, that may not suit us for a picnic spot quite as nicely as a beautiful grassy ponderosa pine forest. But that could be
really critical.
That could be the pathway by which the ecosystem begins to heal itself. You know, you can kind of think of it as scar tissue. It may not come back to look exactly the way it looked before the burn, but what little we understand about these long-term recovery process in ecosystems suggests that they can take many pathways. They can take many pathways to recovery. And so I would say that although the effects of some fires have been devastating, and I've seen some of this devastation, and in fact, one study site of mine in particular had one of these kinds of fires, and trees that I knew personally that are 500 years old are now gone. It's a devastating emotional experience when you lose something like that. And yet, if we ask the same question about the ecosystem as a whole, I would say that there is potential resilience in ecosystems that we do not fully understand.
And I think that we've alluded to this. I want to circle back, and I'm always proud of myself when I get the whirling dervish brain in check, and I try not to be all over the place. But we've talked a little bit about the Forest Service, a little bit about the aftermath of what they're doing immediately once the fire stops burning. What's your personal, professional, scientific thought on control burns and thinning in terms of fire prevention? It always kind of amazes me, coming from a mental health background, we would spend hundreds of billions of dollars on building prisons, I'm exaggerating a little bit, and pennies on prevention. So where does your scientific brain tell us what should we be doing? Control burns, why aren't we doing more of them? Are they a bad thing? Talk about the whole prevention piece of this. Is it possible?
Right. So the understanding of the role of fire in ecosystems has evolved tremendously in the last century. You go from 100 years ago, when it was assumed that fire was completely bad, that had no role, no natural role in the landscape. If a fire occurred, it was a blunder or a mistake or ignorance, and it was something to be eliminated. We've done pretty much 180 degree reversal in that, in terms of understanding fire not only as a natural but as an essential ecosystem process, and one that is essential to forests and grasslands maintaining themselves. The public agencies who implement land management policy have gone through that same evolution from 100 years ago, with a declaration that eliminating fire was, in the famous words of William James, the moral equivalent of war, to now we understand that fire is integral part in land management. And so the Forest Service, the National Park Service, the Bureau of Land Management, all of the federal land managing agencies understand and accept and embrace the idea that fire needs to be on the landscape. That's an evolution that really started about 40 years ago, and with a few brave people saying, you know, instead of putting out every fire, we should actually let fire return to the landscape. That led to what you're describing as controlled burns, or sometimes called prescribed burns, where people actually intentionally go out and set fire under controlled conditions in order to reduce these fuels that we've been talking about. The fact is, if you stop fire, especially in the kinds of climate that we have in the West, the fuels will stay there for a very long time. They don't decompose. Fire is really the only mechanism that will begin to reduce those fuel loadings in any reasonable time fashion. So the bottom line answer to your question is that the agencies, the public agencies, understand completely that there needs to be more fire on the landscape, more low severity, low impact, low intensity fire, which can do a great job of reducing fuels without putting forests and people's houses at risk. The problem is that the hands of the land managing agencies, and I'm just going to speak bluntly here, are absolutely tied both by the politics and to some extent a public misunderstanding of what controlled burning is and how it's conducted. And so agencies, even if they want to put more fire on the landscape, they have a very, very difficult time doing so.
Because of fear and really, truly not enough information. Like when you said there is a vast understanding, and I was going to say, well, not everybody really gets that. The scientists and these public agencies really do, but people are afraid of fire. That's what happens.
Understandably, fire is a big, dangerous beast that eats houses and kills people. That's not an unreasonable fear. In fact, it's probably an instinctual fear. But when we have fires of this gigantic magnitude occurring now, we know, if nothing else, that the idea of suppressing them, that is trying to hold back the tide, is eventually going to be a losing proposition. And so the only way that we can get past that is to bring fire back to the landscape in a more controlled way. Part of the reason that the agencies have a hard time restoring fire is, as you say, the risk. People are not sure that the agencies really know how to manage it. And that's a legitimate question. But I will say the firefighting capacity and firefighting expertise is pretty good in this country, pretty strong. Also, fires generate smoke. It's hard to have a wildland fire without smoke, especially the conditions in which you set a prescribed fire tend to be, ironically, conditions that would tend to keep smoke down to the ground.
Because there's not a lot of high winds.
And so you can bet that the minute the fire goes on, the district ranger's phone starts to ring off the hook saying, you know, what are you doing?
I can't
breathe.
Smoke.
I smell smoke. Go put it out. And members of Congress will start calling in, and pretty soon the district ranger, who may fear for her job if she doesn't, you know, doesn't listen, shuts the fire down. This happens thousands of times every year in the West. And so we have a kind of ideological struggle about whether fire belongs on the landscape or not, and if so, how we're going to manage it.
And, you know, hopefully shows like this will help educate the public and educate our listeners around the Southwest and around the globe about why they're a good thing. Everybody, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. We are in studio with Don Falk, Associate Professor at the University of Arizona School of Natural Resources. I'm Mrs. Green.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Castle Rock Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
It's got advanced technology. It's got major breakthroughs in technology everywhere you look. It's the 2013 Honda Accord. Hi there, this is Mrs. Green, and I want to share with you that after nearly 40 years of heritage, this is the most stunning Accord ever. The highly respected automotive magazine raves that the 2013 Honda Accord offers unparalleled talent of goodness. Please visit Chapman Honda at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson to check it out and see for yourself.
Do you dare to share? In 2009, the University of Arizona started its car sharing program. Today, students, faculty, and staff have access to a shared fleet of cars that includes 7 hybrids and even the zero emissions Nissan Leaf. Not only does car sharing give the campus community wheels, but it takes all those extra cars off the road too. Now that greens things up, doesn't it? The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Are you thinking about swapping out your old items for new? Think Habitat when you do. Don't trash it. Have a store it. Habitat for Humanity Tucson will resell your donated furniture, appliances, and building supplies and use the proceeds to build affordable homes in the greater Tucson area. Call now at 520-889-7200 for a free pickup. You can bring your donations to Habitat's Have a Store at 935 West Grant Road, just a quarter mile east of I-10. For more information, go to HabitatTucson.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And if this show isn't making you think, I dare say you might have fallen asleep. And that is really scary. It's been a great show. My in-studio guest is, he really is Dr. Donald Falk, but now we're Don and Gina. He is a professor, associate professor at the University of Arizona School of Natural Resources and the Environment, highly published, highly recognized nationally and internationally. Don, thanks for being on the show. I want to say that again. I want to tell everybody, stay connected with Mrs. Green's World on Facebook or through my newsletter, because that's where you'll find out about great guests like Don, who are truly committed to creating a global community of people who care about the planet. So let's just jump right into, since we have the time will fly, it all ties into, in my opinion, my very, very highly researched non-scientific opinion, with climate change. We are one planet. There are no isolated incidents. So the flooding, the fires, the devastating storms we're having, all of it are related. Talk about what in God's name is going on in terms of climate change, and why aren't people waking up and demanding that we start really taking it as our highest priority? Because if we don't have a planet, none of this other stuff is going to matter if we burn up.
Right. So let me back up just
one step. You have to back up.
That was me.
I'm politicking here.
I want to back up from one step from your question to give us a kind of running start into that question.
Okay, great. And thanks for guiding it.
That's all right. Because I think if we look at climate change initially through the lens of fire, it will teach us some of this bigger question about climate change in many other areas. So, as you know, as I'm sure your listeners know, the big change to the climate system is the amount of greenhouse gases that we've been putting into the atmosphere through industrial processes. And so we are now at a level of carbon dioxide in particular that has not been seen for 800,000 years, that is before we were a species. And on a permanent level, you have to go back about 3 million years before you see CO2 and methane levels this high. So let's ask, why does that happen? What causes that variability? And I simply want to point out that the big fires that we're seeing now have the signature of climate change. We are seeing exactly what has been predicted for many years by fire scientists, that as the Earth becomes hotter and drier, we will be seeing the conditions that would promote these large, very expansive, very high energy fires. And so climate has influenced fire regimes for millions of years. But the interesting thing is that it goes the other way. Fire puts carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And so you can imagine have a kind of positive feedback circumstance where the climate, as it becomes hotter and drier, our fire seasons are longer. Did you know that fire seasons in the West are now 2 months longer, a month earlier and a month later than they were just a few decades ago? And so there's more climate promoting bigger fires, but that in turn puts more CO2 into the atmosphere. And so that is part of the cycling of ecosystems and Earth's climate system in which fire plays a central role. Now, you ask, why are people not out in the streets demonstrating about this and calling their
congressmen instead of their smoke? Why isn't there smoke?
Right. Well, of course, this week,
wouldn't be anybody to call.
There's nobody home at the Forest Service.
Right.
There's nobody at the National Institutes of Health.
No.
There's nobody at the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, which is the main climate monitor.
Which might warn us of like another tsunami.
There's nobody home at NASA operating all those the Earth orbital satellites. And so
it's disgraceful.
So at the particular date at which we're recording this show, we have a peculiarly American form of insanity.
Don't call
going
anybody.
On. But let's step back from that. I think that what's happening this week with the government shutdown and more broadly the sequestering is the same answer to why we're not getting progress on climate change. And I think it's fair to say without saying this in a partisan way that our political system is so wrapped up with prevailing corporate and economic interests that it's very, very hard for us to break out into any kind of new action that would challenge that. And the reason that's relevant, of course, is that one of the fundamental principles of addressing climate change has to be a serious commitment to not just reduce, but eliminate the use of fossil fuels as quickly as possible. Well, for our economy, that is about as radical an idea as you can propose. If you do the numbers and you assume our current population not crashing, so the current number of people, our current levels of affluence, that is not wanting to go into a major depression, and the per capita consumption, you simply do those numbers. You have us burning coal, you have us burning natural gas, you have us burning petroleum for several decades to come. And now we're looking at CO2 levels not at 400, which is already well above what climate scientists were saying was the safe level of 350, and that only because 350 would keep climate temperature, global temperatures from increasing less than 2 degrees centigrade. Now we're at 400. If you put all that, those hydrocarbons into the air, same way, by the way, that fire does, it's just really breaking the chemical bonds in hydrocarbons. They happen to be tree-based, but they're hydrocarbons nonetheless. Now you're looking at CO2 levels that are 500 parts per million, and you start to get to levels that have not been seen for millions of years. I think that it's very difficult for most people to grasp the magnitude of the challenge that our society is facing. We've never really altered the planetary system to this scale. We've done it on a local scale. We've messed up rivers and polluted air and polluted waterways and clear-cut forests and caused the extinction of species. Most of those things are somewhat localized. I think it's fair to say that the climate crisis, and it is a crisis, even though it's creeping very slowly and almost invisibly, is different from anything else that we've encountered previously, precisely because it is global.
And I could not agree with you more. I have friends, very dear friends, very highly educated, very active people in the world itself that say to me, I don't want to talk about it. Like, I can't even absorb this. I don't want us to talk about it anymore. And it's too heavy for me to understand. And to me, it's like, how can we shift that conversation to this is one of the most important things that we as a planet, as a population, need to be talking about, not be afraid of it, and start to tip the scales the other way. We need another tipping point in the other way. And if you look at it, let's talk about some of the things that you quoted in one of your articles. There isn't disagreement in the global scientific community about the causative relationship of people to the acceleration of climate change. There really isn't a lot of dissension there.
You hear in the blogosphere and talk radio every now and then that even scientists don't agree about climate change. And
there are three that don't.
And so we decided to look at that question. And there is a very interesting piece of research that polled tens of thousands of climate scientists around the world and asked them a series of questions about what's driving the current change in global climate. And their summation of the amount of disagreement on the question of whether humans are driving climate change is that the disagreement is vanishingly small. It is a higher degree of consensus than on almost any other major scientific issue. And so the scientific community understands very clearly what is happening. I think it's important to note also that this is not something that one country can fix alone.
Right.
If it's a global problem, there also has to be a global solution. When we published this article just a week or so ago, I got a number of letters in my inbox, one of them saying, well, this is great, but isn't it true that the United States could get our house in order and China and India and other countries would still be polluting the atmosphere with CO2 and we'd be no better off? And they're absolutely right. It's absolutely true.
We have been
historically the biggest polluter, we've now been surpassed by China. But if you take the total amount of CO2 in the atmosphere that has our name on it, we're still the primary owner of the biggest portion of that carbon dioxide. But the fact is that this is a chance for the United States to show some leadership. If we, for example, if we and Western Europe and Australia and a few other countries around the world that are really ready to take action got together and said, you know, one of the rules for the global economy will be that products have to be produced sustainably. And sustainably means not contributing to climate change. And we simply won't buy products that aren't made in a sustainable fashion. That would create a huge market, a sustainability market, and it would put countries that are not producing sustainably at a real disadvantage. So I think that there are ways that we could use the international economic and diplomatic system in order to bring pressure to bear on other countries that we think are just going to do their own thing. In today's interdependent economy, there is no country that is immune from those kinds of pressures. And so there are ways, I think, for us to address this on a global scale.
And in the mosaic that I look at by interviewing guests every week, sometimes twice a week, there are rays of hope. There are some things that you see that are happening, that are changing. What I don't understand is, and you delve into it more deeply, more openly, about when you talk about the corporate influence, because what you can lead yourself to believe is all of these companies and their CSRs and their commitments to sustainability and their, you know, their stand on reducing their carbon imprint. Why is that some of the spin when, in fact, corporations who should be leaders at the table on demanding this, is it really all about greed and return on investment?
Well,
that's what I want to ask you.
Right, right. So the reason I made the connection to the current government shutdown and to the sequestration is that our political system has a very difficult time dealing with major changes in how we do business. Look at the debate over the healthcare law, which for many other countries would have been so obvious. You know, what? You have 30 million people without healthcare and 15 million children. Of course you want to deal with that.
Right.
Well, dealing with climate change is going to be one of those. Let's be clear about it. Let's be honest. It's going to be a major change in how we do business, because it's going to require us to learn to live within a sustainability budget. For example, if you have 300 million people all wanting to live at a very high level of affluence and the way that we like to in this country, well, then you multiply those two things together, your global impact is going to be very, very significant. So you either reduce the level of affluence, well, we don't want to do that, or you start to look at ways to limit global population. Maybe we can't have 12 billion people driving SUVs around the planet and still have a sustainable planet. So I think the fact that we're seeing any movement at all is an encouraging sign. But I also think it's important to recognize that climate change is not simply a technical fix. It requires us to rethink very, very deeply our premises about how our economy is wired and our relationship to the earth as a system and our role in that system.
And I spent 10 days in New York doing all things green and beautiful, and spent time with people like Jane Goodall, and went to a presentation one night for an organization that I'm now just a huge fan of called Food Tank, and it's about food waste. And they're creating massive efforts to reduce food waste, to take the food waste and turn it into either composting or, you know, they're really making a difference. It's one of those glimmers of hope. That being said, what you're talking about is a fundamental shift in the way that we think about the houses we're living in and feeling uncomfortable about them. I heard this one young man who was young man saying, I'm living my calling. And what he's doing is building 56,000 square feet greenhouses near major cities to simply provide them with tomatoes and lettuce so they don't have to be shipped literally 1,500, 3,000 miles from growing in California to a table in New York City. So there are things like that that will make us locavores.
The good news is that we absolutely have the skill.
Tell me, Don.
We have the skill and the spirit and the intelligence and the capacity to solve this problem. It is well within our grasp.
It is.
The bad news is the politics. The bad news is that there will be winners and losers. The companies that primarily are engaged in the production of fossil fuels, including coal, would be a loser in this rearrangement of the earth to a more sustainable economy. We know that. Now, maybe there are other things that could be used with those products, but combusting them and putting them up into the atmosphere where they contribute to destruction of the planet probably would not be on that list. And so anytime you have winners and losers and you have people invested in the status quo, it's understandable that that you have a formula for, at the very least, a heated political debate and at worst a kind of gridlock. So let's not kid ourselves that it's going to be easy. But I think it's important to say that we have all the knowledge and I think all the will and all the passion to solve this problem that is needed to keep the earth alive and sustainable. The problem will be, and the challenge for us will be, to get people together to understand our global common interest, not only as people and ecosystems, because after all, you can't have just people without ecosystems living on the planet. You've got to solve the equation for both of them. this is something we absolutely can do, but we have to address both the technology and the decision-making and the sociology, and also find a way to get work through the very difficult political debate that's ahead.
Okay, so we have about a minute, a little bit more. One nugget for people that are listening and might be feeling this is daunting, this is overwhelming, I'm glad I listened. One takeaway for them that would be a call to action that you'd say, sitting here, look in their eyes and say, do this. What would you tell them to do?
I would tell them, can I have two? I'll tell them to do two things. One, take a long, hard, honest look at how you live, how much you drive, how big your house is, how big your appliances are. How about that plasma TV in your bathroom?
What kind of car you're driving.
Right. So take a very careful look at your own lifestyle and ask yourself if you yourself are living sustainably. And if you're not sure about that, go on the web and look. You can calculate your ecological footprint. That's one thing. And the other thing I would have to say is to be engaged politically. Be engaged with organizations that are working on climate change, like 350.org. Write your congressman. Make your voice heard.
For the greater good. For the greater good, for all our sakes. Everybody, this was a great show. Time flew. Next week, Steve Ritz, the Green Bronx Machine, who is creating a new Bronx and a new planet full of hope for everybody. Thanks, everybody. Make it a great green week. Don Falk, thank you.
Thank you.